who was shot by a hunter who mistook her hat for a bird. All right, I'm sorry, Johnny. You're a very serious person, too. I want you to get out here. You know, speaking of serious problems, and we must clear up a few of them tonight, then one of them is that the world is full of a number of phonies. Various types. They come in various sizes, shapes, colors, persuasions, and I think one of the most interesting phonies, and I think all of us have run into this practically daily, or at least once a month. How often do you get a letter marked, it comes usually typewritten, and it says, "Do not break the chain." The following men got $20,000 because they kept the chain. General Curtis LeMay. Add your name to the bottom of the list and send the letter on. Do you know anybody who has ever added his name to the bottom of the list and sent it on? I have never known anyone. I get one of these every couple of days, and it says, "You will be dogged by bad luck all of your life if you break the chain." Well, maybe that's the problem. I wonder if Nixon might have broken a chain, didn't send one of those letters, it's all hit the fan. I don't know. It's just a theory. I've never sent one of these letters in, but here's one that I'm sure that you haven't gotten, but this is the kind of stuff that people in showbiz get constantly. It's a certain type of phony that is related to the autograph hound. Here's a letter that I got from Arvada, Colorado. I presume there is such a place. It's a very official-looking letter. It's got stationery, letterhead, and all that. It says, Arvada, Colorado. And it says, and I quote, "Dear Miss Shepherd, I have been a fan of yours for years, and I am collecting autographs. And I was wondering if you might send me an autograph photograph of yourself. It would be added to such autograph photographs as Carl Sandburg, Ignace Jean Paderewski, and Miss Helen Keller. Best of luck, Miss Shepherd, throughout the coming years to you and your program. Thanking you for your assistance, I remain one of your oldest fans." I presume he's talking about Miss Carl Sandburg, who was a famous suffragette. Now you just figure out what the meaning of this is. You see, this is speaking of a great phony. That reminds me of a letter I one time got to talk about terrible phony problems that developed. I got a letter here not too long ago, and it said, "I was in New York just for a couple of days, Miss Shepherd, and I was in my hotel room and I was listening to your show. You do one of the best women's show in the air. And, Miss, you don't mind if I call you Jean, your first name. I just want to say that you have one hell of a woman's show. And if there's anything I can do to help your show along, you just let me know. Charles W. Bullard, fantastic press agent, write to him and he'll help me along." Now, I don't know what these things mean. I get at least three letters a day marked Ms. M.S., Ms. It's all part of the lack of... I think that identification is one of the chief problems today. Everybody's looking for identity. Look for identity. It'd be discouraging if you really tried to find identity. What if you really found out who you were? You realize this could destroy you. I mean, you found out your true worth. You found out what you actually are. Now, I'm serious. There's some things you don't want to know, friend. And, we're getting theological here at this point, and we don't want to get too deeply into that. I must say this, though, that many people identify themselves by the products that they buy. Have you noticed the ecstasy on the faces of those clods who watch those and are part of those strange shows that go on all day long in television? I bet a lot of people who have been watching Watergate off and on have suddenly found themselves inadvertently seeing things like, "And now, here he is, big Charlie Brown and his tremendous giveaway show. Hit the ding-dong. And here's a bunch of goofy-looking people sitting up there screaming and yelling over a refrigerator. Have you seen any of those bits? Who the hell watches that stuff? I'm asking a very serious question. Is there anybody out there who really seriously watches these game shows? Day after day, week after week, are you telling me, Joe, they do it all the time? And those people are allowed to vote? Good God. I think one of the greatest criteria of our civilization is what passes for entertainment. It is fascinating. I think it says a lot more than what our so-called art is. You know, we tend to judge a civilization by its art, which I think is wrong. I really do. I mean, I've always felt this, that we tend to judge, say, the Greeks by their architecture and the elegant style of their artistic development. And we tend to judge the Renaissance by the artists, what they turned out during that period. What I would like to see, I mean, you really learn a lot more about the Renaissance if you were able to attend a real bear baiting. I mean, you know, they bring in the bears, you know, and everybody's sitting there yelling and hollering. What do they do with a bear? Well, they got about five great big tough dogs. This is how bear baiting works. You realize how it works, don't you, Joe? Wouldn't you like to? But now that would really say it about these guys. You know, they're yelling and hollering. Right next door, you see they're putting on Hamlet. And and the bears, and we're charging up. In fact, there are some accounts that are gleeful. Of the period when the bear actually got away and charged up and took care of about half the audience, which gave a fantastic doubleheader that day to the guys that survived. I mean, that was tremendous. And I say that the real life of the people of the time can never be judged by the artwork. Now, can you imagine, say, judging our time by, say, the works of Henry Moore, the sculptor? Can you imagine by looking at Henry Moore, you know who he is, the English sculptor. I mean, he's part of our time. Jacques Lipchitz, Pablo Picasso. Can you imagine judging, say, Archie Bunker by those guys? No way. I mean, you wouldn't. Unfortunately, the art is what usually survives, you know, because that stuff is kept in museums. They don't keep the film of the Grandma Demolition Derby in Islip, Long Island, in the museum, which should be kept. I mean, this is closer to the real truth than... you agree with that, Joe? It's closer to the real truth than any of the so-called self-conscious art forms. And I would like to suggest here, this is a Shepherd's suggestion of the month, I would like to suggest that we take some of our money. You know, the federal government has a cultural fund, which it contributes to such elegant establishments as Lincoln Center. You know, that great vast mausoleum of affluence up there on Columbus Circle, and they build things like the John F. Kennedy Auditorium for the Performing Arts. Well, you know, this is a nice thing for Jackie Kennedy to go to, and it's a kind of a nice thing for gives Lenny Bernstein a job and all that, you know. But it doesn't have much to do with what you know, a lot of guys named Herbie and Aki are doing, walking around out there, you know, places like Rabbit Hash, Kentucky, and you know. Culture centers such as Secaucus. So what I would like to submit an idea for, so that we could preserve some of our real culture for later on. You know, for people who come, say, 200 or 300 years from now, they would find it fascinating. Do you agree? Do you agree that we would find, if somehow magically back in the days of the Renaissance, Shakespeare's day, back in those days, if somehow magically somebody could have frozen a bear baiting session in its full gore, right the way it was. Wouldn't you pay a quarter or so to see that? Wouldn't you go see what they were really like in those days? All these guys, you know, these because, you know, there was a certain look to the Renaissance man, according to some of the paintings. He had a certain wild-eyed look. If you've ever seen paintings of some of these guys who come out of, say, such painters as Hieronymus Bosch, he liked to paint people of that ilk, going to hell, of course, screaming every way. And nevertheless, it would be kind of exciting. In some way, if we could spend enough money to preserve the average klutz, one average klutz out of every given civilization, and keep them alive somehow, so that other civilizations could come and see him, and watch him do his thing. of course, this is the kind of stuff you see in the Wide Wide World of Sports on ABC every week. You've seen those, you know, these the dune buggy races and all this kind of stuff, which of course add a great deal to the cultural achievements of our time. But the alligator wrestlers. I saw that as a kind of an exciting one. But I think probably the greatest slob display that I ever saw in my life, and I wish somebody had preserved it. It's not even remembered by most people. It was so immense that people don't remember it. I have a theory that the larger the scene, the more immense the publicity, the quicker a thing is forgotten. I can't hardly remember a Super Bowl game. And there's an endless reams of publicity about those things beforehand. There's, you know, great deathless battles are about to be waged between quarterbacks. And 3 days later, I can't even remember who the two teams were to play. You know, the whole nation watches. I can't remember it anymore after a while. It's quickly forgotten. And it's billed as a deathless battle. Now, I just wonder about that. Like the other day, I'm walking down the street on 8th Street. You know, they have all these art theaters along there. See, we're living in an age of total hyperbole. The adjective knows no bounds. If the word fantastic is used once, it's used 1,000 times in your average ad. Everything is fantastic, from ketchup, you name it, cat food, it's all fantastic. Now, how much further can you go than fantastic as an adjective? Fantastic really says it's so unbelievably good that it is a fantasy. It can't go much beyond that. But the word is used now with such commonality. It's used so commonly that it has no meaning. So we are living in the age of hyperbole, particularly in the critical world. The critical world is given to this. I pick up practically every day some guy leads off his criticism of a new book in the Times. Some guy with five or six names, you know, Christopher Lehman Haupt Jr., something like that. They all have names like that. Anatole Parker McGillicully Boyard. Great names. In fact, I'll never forget a great line by George Ade. He said that there are two kinds of people to beware of. Presbyterian ministers who use three names, and literary critics who use three or more names. And so they're both in the same bourgeois line, which reminds me, this is WOR New York. But do you have a thing in there for me, Joe? Please hit the L button, please.
Tonight, instead of the usual before dinner, how about a DuVernay before dinner? DuVernay Company, New York, New York.
Oh, yeah, it was elegant. Every time I hear the word DuVernay, I always think of Charles Boyer sitting there, you know, in a scene with Carol Lombard. And between them, they have one of these French ashtrays that says something on it. You know, those ashtrays with names of stuff. I don't know. You know. Now, by the way, friends, the people Don Crickey has been interviewing about Barclay's traveler's checks. And incidentally, I use the word friends there with a slight touch of sardonic, ironic wit. The people Don Crickey has been interviewing about Barclay's. Has he been interviewing people about Barclay's, Don Crickey? Remember when he used to do those big things? Yeah. Now he's interviewing people about Barclays. Oh, well. What is a Barkley? Isn't a Barkley one of those small alligator bags? Comes with a brass lock on it. Well, can't you get the folding Barkley? Yeah, well, anyway, he's been doing it. Says he's been interviewing about Barkley traveler's checks, and he says they have good reasons for buying them. For example, Barclays is a bit more prestigious than other checks. Honey, the only prestigious check that I know of is one that has big numbers on it. But I suppose... anyway, there's a great prestige connected with the presentation of a Barclays traveler's check. It's spelled with a Q-U-E, friends. Most experienced travelers know that Barclays is accepted and respected the world over. And let's see, here's some information you may not know. Things you were always curious about, but you never had enough get up and go to find out. Barclays is the fourth biggest group of banks in the world, with $24 billion in assets. Well, that's a lot of cabbage. $24 billion, and here they are advertising on our show. Barclays has over 5,000 branches in 56 countries. 50 in Israel, for example. 150 in the Caribbean. I wonder how many they got in Kuwait. They don't need checks over there in Kuwait. If you're one of those oil sheiks, you don't need no checks. You just keep your money in great big barrels. That's all. You know, that's the way to go. Now that you know about Barclays traveler's checks, why don't you let them go with you this summer? And let's see, in New Jersey, Barclays traveler's checks are available free of charge to travel club members only at Cooperative Savings and Loan of Ridgewood. Okay. I'll keep these off to one side here, if I may, for a while here, if you don't mind. But, you know, I must say, though, that... I think we were onto a good thing there. I seriously think that in this age of hyperbola, this age of the overblown adjective where everything is fantastic, nothing is fantastic. So ultimately, hardly anybody remembers anything. We're told to watch everything, this big thing that's going to happen, and it comes on TV, and you watch it. The entire population is sitting at the edge of his seats waiting to see what's going to happen in the second quarter. And after it's over, you can't remember it. Get up, you walk around, and you have a drink. And by nightfall, it's all gone. The shards have fallen. And just like one of the great events that occurred in my time that I actually saw, I was there. And you know, I can't get anybody to remember it. Life magazine. You remember Life magazine? It's amazing how quickly you forget that. Well, wait, there used to be a Life magazine. You don't remember that? Very good. Most people today have trouble remembering last Wednesday. Very much trouble. Difficult. Very much. I'm thinking of putting together an LP called Favorite Crises of Our Time. You know, like, you forget these crises. Do you, how many of you remember Sherman Adams? Remember old Sherman? Well, he practically called the government. It caused the government to topple. He was the Watergate of his day. You don't even remember it. And everybody likes to think that Watergate will be remembered. Well, I'm going to guarantee you, in 3 years, Watergate will be a little tiny footnote like all other crises of our time. Now, I'm not going to say I think this is the way it should be. I'm making no value judgment. I'm saying this is the way it will be. Very few people. Do you remember when everybody sat around by the millions and watched the crime commission hearings on television? Who was the senator that became famous over that one? Yeah. That's right. Remember Kefauver in his coonskin cap? See, apparently these giant TV spectaculars always vault a senator on the committee, whatever the committee is, into a presidential candidacy. Well, already they're talking about Baker for some reason because he asked such cute questions. Well, I'll tell you, there's a touch of madness to the Americans. It's just, and I'm one of them, so I'm qualified to talk about it. The madness in our times. I read a review on Norman Mailer's book, the one about Marilyn Monroe, and he admits tacitly somewhere along the line he never met her. However, she once lived 5 miles from him. And so naturally, he felt the vibrations and... I mean, what amazes me about our time is that we could take stuff like that seriously and give it the front page of the New York Times book review section. You know, that is, to my way of thinking, that is ultimate hyperbole. That's the ultimate rip. But, you know, that's a part of our time. And it has to be accepted. But now I think this is what makes our time so curiously hallucinogenic. Who are these people that take stuff like Marilyn Monroe, written by Norman Mailer, seriously? Who are these people? Now, I'm just asking a rhetorical question. Who are they? Are you one of them? Do you? Are you, Jerry, one of them? Are you, Joe? Joe never heard about it. Well, the question is, who are they? I mean, I'm just wondering who they are. Who cares what Gay Talese says about sex? I mean, who are the people who care about these things? I'm just curious who they are. I just wonder whether there's just nobody that cares. Well, you know, all part of that whole enormous, very subtle business we have today called publicity. And I've often felt that the things that people really care about are rarely mentioned. In other words, something that is so universal that everybody does secretly care about it, it's never mentioned. Like the other day, for example, I did a show just out of the blue. I did a show on ice cream. Well, it turns out I got a whole raft of letters on that. Apparently, people are really concerned about ice cream, but the Times rarely mentions ice cream. I mean, not that ice cream is unimportant. It isn't. But then again, is a book by Norman Mailer about Marilyn Monroe that important? Question is, especially, you never met... And by the way, I must say that I did meet Marilyn Monroe, and I talked to her at great length on more than several occasions in various... And both, I suppose you might say, semi-social and also professional terms. And it never occurred to me to pretend to intimacy, and yet that doesn't bother people. I mean, you just write this giant book about what you thought during Marilyn Monroe pictures. That in itself is a big issue. Of course, you have to have a certain kind of ego to believe that everything you think is of earth-shaking importance, and maybe more important than the subject itself. That's part of it. But I'm going to ask you a question. Just a few years ago, what was one of the biggest events held in New York? I'll give you a clue. It was held in Madison Square Garden. It was one of the most publicized events of the time, and nobody today, hardly a man alive, remembers it. And the entire garden was packed filled with as many people could get in there. And one of the biggest topics during the period that this was going on was to get an invitation to that thing, which incidentally you paid for. You did not get this. That's what made it fascinating. 18,000 people, and they charged $20 per seat to get in. And what was it? Well, it was Mike Todd's birthday party. Now, I think that was a very significant thing of our time. It was the first giant non-event. Now, what is a non-event? Well, a non-event is something that seems to be important merely because a lot of people write about it. It's a non-event. Now, an event is something that is an event. And it just happens. Like, for example, the sinking of the Andrea Doria was an event. Okay? There it is. It's laying on the bottom of the ocean. You can point right to it and you say, that's where it went down and it happened. Watergate is an event. It genuinely is. But a non-event is a classical non-event. There are many kinds of non-events. There's the non-event that relates to, say, a thing like Mike Todd's birthday party, which if you don't remember it... was an unbelievable situation. I'll never forget the sight. We broadcast it, you know. I did the play-by-play, and it's the only radio broadcast of it. I mean, it was really a spectacular broadcast, and you'll never guess who worked with it on me. John Gambling. The two of us laughing like hell. That was one of the few nights that John's basic sardonic wit came out, and it did. And we were up in the press box where they usually broadcast hockey games, and we were sitting up there, and you had to wear tuxedos and the whole bit, watching the waiters run up and down in the balcony selling people champagne, which was supposed to be given to the people who came to the party. At $10 a bottle, and they were selling this $2 champagne, which Mike Todd got free. And each one had a big thing on the side that says, courtesy of the International Fig Newton Northern State Champagne Company. And then they wheeled out the food, and there was big, big cards that said, courtesy of Nathan's. Yeah, I'm not kidding you. And nobody got anything. And I remember one great scene that sticks in my mind of Elizabeth Taylor looking like a Hebrew national salami. She was really bulging, I'll tell you. It was like she had been injected into this purple dress. And the purple was at least three sizes smaller than she was, and she was just bulging out all over the place. Climbing up on a ladder. Now, get this scene. If you want to see a Romanesque, a totally barbaric picture of our time. They had right in the middle of the arena, Madison Square Garden, this is the old garden, and it had a great big floor. If you ever saw the garden, it had stands all the way around it, you know, an upper deck and triple deck, and had decks that went all the way up into the sky. I mean, you know, you could buy a seat so high you couldn't even see the ground from up there, you know. See, this was all an ostensible celebration for the birthday of Mike Todd, a producer of astounding turkeys of various types, So, nevertheless, right in the middle of the floor, and everybody came to it. I don't know why, and it was a whole big deal to try to get invited. So, right in the middle of the floor, right smack in the middle, was his birthday cake. It was billed as the world's largest birthday cake, the greatest birthday cake ever made, the greatest, largest, most fantastic birthday cake that the world has ever seen. And I wouldn't doubt it. That birthday cake was about, I would guess, offhand, I would say, about two stories high. I'm not kidding you, about 25 feet high. Now, it was about, in circumference, it was probably 30 feet around. And it was in two or three giant tiers. It went up like it was tiered, see. And it had decoration all over, happy birthday, Mike, and all that stuff, and enormous icing letters. But the first thing that hit me was the color of it. Now, it's a birthday cake. Now, I say birthday cake, and you think in terms of white icing and pink icing. This was the most bilious-looking birthday cake. It was obscene. It was purple. Yes, it was purple. And what it looked like was lukewarm, watered, diluted, purple grape Kool-Aid. Now, that's not so good-looking for starters, but this was really an obscene cake. And here it was, standing in the middle of the floor. Well, now, there were a lot of things I keep bringing back from that fantastic scene. I don't know why I'm telling you this, except that I want to remind people of the kind of stuff that goes on. Now, I saw this, and many of you remember it, but not many of you actually were there and saw it happen. And there's no way to describe what it was like. At one end of the arena was, for some strange reason, the Boston Pops Orchestra with Arthur Fiedler. He was conducting, and they were playing stuff like the theme from Around the World in 80 Days, and he's playing it away there, see. And this is echoing throughout this enormous arena. You can't hear a damn thing. Off on the left here, on the other side, for some strange reason, while the music is playing, Hubert Humphrey, Senator Hubert Humphrey, is giving a totally fatuous speech, somehow connecting... He's never lived that one down. Somehow connecting Mike Todd and Around the World in 80 Days with global politics. And we were entering a new era of good feeling and beauty and truth. And it was all going to come about through show business and Mike Todd and Ron. And he's up there, and I say to you, as the senator from Minnesota, and all the while this orchestra's playing. In fact, you can't hear a damn thing. It's just a giant uproar. But the great sight of the thing is Elizabeth Taylor, who at the time was married to this Todd, climbing up a ladder to get to the top of the cake. Now, picture the scene now. Elizabeth Taylor in a dress at least 15 to 20 sizes too small for her, and a long one. It went right down to her feet, see? And I'll tell you, she was coming out of the top of that dress. It was fantastic. It looked like a cornucopia that was spewing out cantaloupes. here she was, see? And she's climbing up this ladder to get to the top of a purple cake. And the crowd is cheering, see? And they wheeled out a great big cart being towed by two donkeys that was covered with hot dogs, had a big sign that said, courtesy of Nathan's, that Boston Pops was playing, Hubert Humphrey was giving a speech, and over across the way there, I could see a Ginger Rogers, of all things, holding court. A lot of photographers were down there, and the waiters were running up and down, selling the champagne. People were getting mad, and suddenly, without any warning, about 14 guys wearing black leather jackets broke into the side doorway, which was over by 8th Avenue, ran in and started to steal the door prizes right off the floor. They're running out with them. The guy grabs the outboard motor and he's running out before 20,000 people. Probably the greatest public ripoff in history. At that point, Hubert Humphrey's up there saying, "And I see before us a period of unparalleled peace and prosperity and international," and he's going on, and this guy runs right by him, carrying the motor, and Humphrey doesn't even see it. He's up there in the orchestra. And with that, suddenly, the crowd has had enough of it. See, they've seen this Grecian scene. Sir Cedric Hardwick has fallen off an elephant. His glasses got busted, stepped on by an elephant, and he's carried, kicking and fighting out of the auditorium. I don't know what he was doing on an elephant. At that point, five dogs ran out and chased a horse around. He got mad and ran up to the stage, right up into the stands. Well, the people are getting bugged, and they started to come charging down when the cake is up there. They wanted some of the cake. They had gotten no champagne. They paid $20. They were supposed to get food. They got nothing. And so they all charged down, and at that point, Elizabeth Taylor is now at the top of the ladder of this, you know, two-story-high cake. He's up on a ladder. Just a little ladder went down. She's got a tremendous knife that was about 30 feet long, it looked like, and she just takes the knife and goes, sticks it into the cake like she's stabbing a dinosaur. See, now, on cue, the Boston Pops was supposed to play an enormous Gregorian chant or something, because they started to play the trumpets, and she goes, with the knife again. I thought, my God, this is right out of Rome. Well, the crowd is surging around, see, and they're wearing tuxedos and all, you know, it's all full dress. Well, obviously, they were not going to get pieces of this cake, see, so the crowd, like the mob always does, took matters in its own hand. They charged the cake, and they're tearing off pieces of it. These are all people from society. They got big chunks of purple cake, and they're eating it. At that point, Elizabeth Taylor sees what's going on, and she joins right in with it. She lops off a big chunk of cake and throws it out into the audience. And they go, ah, they cheer. She's throwing cakes out into the audience. The people are cheering and hollering. I thought, oh, my God, I'll never see another thing like this in my whole life. Elizabeth Taylor up there chopping up cake and throwing purple cake down. And then another unforgettable scene. The most elegant man that I've known in years is Ben Grauer. Ben Grauer, for some strange reason, wandered past me with a gigantic balloon. And the balloon said, "I eat hot dogs at Nathan's." And he's got a balloon. No, don't ask me why he had a balloon that says, "I eat hot dogs at Nathan's." I'm sure Ben Grauer does not. But nevertheless, he walked past me with a dazed look on his eye, and a big piece of cake hit him right between the shoulder blades. It goes, he turns around, "Oh, great Scott." You know, he's an elegant man. And as he turns around, a lot of plastic toys, which Ben, I don't know why he was picking these up. They had all kinds of little souvenirs, like a souvenir of Avis and that they were giving away. And plastic toys start falling out of his tuxedo. And I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we are present at a Grecian, a Roman orgy, the likes of which that they have not seen since Attila the Hun packed it in and gave it up." and began to develop arthritis. This is fantastic. Hey, Elizabeth Taylor is now throwing a giant chunk of cake at the Ginger Rogers. Beautiful. Look at that left hand. And you hear this crashing cake. Oh, what a scene. And so we are now living in days when that kind of an event is given great publicity. I'm reminded of it when I see reviews of Maryland. I don't know what the connection is, but it seems to me very closely related. Only this time it's Norman Mailer up on top of the ladder, see, throwing great big purple chunks of gooey, squishy cake in the direction of the New York Times book reviewer. Would you please hit the button there, please? Oh, we have a live one, yes. A live one. Now, here's a message for you if you suffer from the city apartment blues. What the heck is this? This is very interesting. Congestion, pollution, being awakened by police sirens or grinding garbage trucks. I prefer garbage. I think Jonathan Winters has brought a little elegance to our time. We in garbage. How would you like to have your own special place to escape to on weekends and vacations, where the only night sounds are the rustle of leaves and a gentle breeze? All right, if you love fishing, Times Square boating, it's just 105 miles from Times Square, and its name is The Hideout. The Hideout. Okay. Oh, well, what better spot to have on the air, you know, during days of truly gargantuan, almost Augustinian debaucheries than a spot for cocktail mixes? Holland House cocktail mixes are available at food stores anywhere. I mean, there are over 30 Holland House dry mixes and liquids to choose from. Let's see, with Holland House cocktail mixes, every drink, every time, will taste as good as if you've made it from scratch. I will not even follow up the obvious pun there. Holland House has been making great mixes for over 100 years. You're trying to think of it as well? I have a literal mind. I keep thinking of somebody trying to make a drink out of scratch. In my terms, scratch means money. And I can see this guy marinating $10 bills. I mean, you know, I'm sorry. Holland House dry mixes are individually triple sealed in foil, so you can always be sure of lasting freshness. Yes, sir. They taste naturally fresh, Holland House cocktail mixes, because they started with fresh, natural ingredients. And that's what they do, Holland House. It makes it easy. All you do is add ice and your favorite beverage. Holland House lets you spend more time enjoying a great drink and a lot less time making it. Available at your neighborhood associated food store. There. That was nice. But the non-event is one of our major products of our time, and I say these things should be preserved. Now, that was the original premise of the show tonight, right? I would like to see Mike Todd's birthday party sealed in plastic. You know, the way they seal stuff in stores where you're going to keep you from stealing the stuff, you know, put a little plastic. Just seal it, you know, an airproof plastic. Just pour it over there. Catch Ben Grauer in mid-stride, standing there with his balloon that says, "I eat hot dogs at Nathan's." That would have been a tremendous exhibit for people 200-300 years from now who want to see what our life is like. What are some of the things that you would like to have seen in your day? I mean, out of the past, would you like to attend? Would you like to attend, say, the usual doubleheader Sunday card at the Coliseum during the great days of Caligula? That would have been an exciting event, wouldn't it? You might have attended it, friend, as one of the participants, but nevertheless, wouldn't you like to attend? There are a lot of things I would like to attend. I would like to have attended the Roman Senate during the days of Caligula. It has obvious connotations today too. You know, Caligula was famous for having a horse elected to the Senate. There are other things. Wouldn't you like to have attended the actual embarkation of Columbus's boats? You know, the Santa Maria. I mean, can you imagine these guys leaving and the boredom of the local guys hanging around the docks? Yeah, well, you know how workers are. Nobody gets excited. I'd like to have been in the next field, two fields removed from the place where they signed the Magna Carta, and talked to one of the serfs. You know, why don't you go down and watch those guys sign that thing? Ah, those barons are always doing that stuff. I mean, why waste your time with the barons, you know? there are several events that I would like to have attended, not necessarily great historical events. I would like to, for example, I would like to see a scene. I would like to have walked into Benjamin Franklin's printing house and, we'll just walk in there and order some QSL cards. You know, walk in and order, from Ben. See what kind of a guy he was, under those circumstances. See, I would like to come to the front door of Monticello, knock on the door and say, is George in? And isn't that where George lived? No, I didn't think so. That was Thomas Jefferson, right? Where did George live? Mount Vernon? Aye, that's what I thought. See, and knocking, says, is George there? And the lady says, no, he's not in yet. So, well, tell him I was around. Tell him I was here, the cigar salesman. And, George smokes cigars. Did you know that? And I would like to have been the cigar salesman who went and got an order from George Washington. I just saw him under completely those circumstances. I would like to be the guy that came in and, was the shoe salesman that sold Abe Lincoln his gaiters. Sat there and said, you're very hard to fit, Mr. Lincoln. Size 23 quadruple A. That's not an easy size to fit. However, if they reach us down into his thing and see him under those conditions, I would like to have been the orderly in General Grant's tent when some very elegant general came in and tried to convince him that tonight before dinner he ought to have an elegant mixed drink like a Manhattan, instead of drinking it out of the barrel with a ladle the way he drank it. These are all the little bits of history. But of course, in our time, one of the most interesting events that I would like to have seen is the inner circle discussion between the editors of the New York Times Book Review section when they decided to put on the front page and Norman Mailer's whatever it is non-event. I get here and say, well, it's going to be a big seller. After all, we got to get on it, George. Somebody says, well, yeah, maybe get a piece of that. After all, I'm bringing out my memoirs next year, and I... So bring it up there large for his friends. These are difficult times for a man of sense.